Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and thanks to our three speakers. Anne and I put this on at very late notice, and all our speakers agreed to come, and they're very busy people, so we're very grateful. We're discussing the 2001 election campaign. Sorry.
If only.
We're discussing the 2010 election campaign, and we have three speakers who are introduced in the order in which they will speak. Our speakers will talk for about 15 minutes each. We'll take questions and discussion and finish no later than 7 o'clock, perhaps a little bit before, but no later than 7 o'clock. So tonight we have Paul Kelly and Peter Harcher making welcome returns to the Sydney Institute, and Claire Harvey speaking here for the first time. So Paul Kelly, as you know, is editor-at-large at The Australian, and his most recent book is The March of Patriots, and Paul addressed the Institute on the March of Patriots not so long ago. Claire Harvey is a senior writer at the Sunday Telegraph, and before going to the Sunday Telegraph, Claire Harvey wrote for The Australian. And Peter Harcher, political editor of the Sydney Morning Herald, and his most recent book is To the Bitter End, and Peter Harcher addressed that book quite recently. So we'll start off with Paul Kelly, then Claire Harvey, then Peter Harcher, then questions and discussion. Paul, thank you.
Thanks, Gerard. It's great to be back at the Sydney Institute with Gerard and Anne Henderson participating in their contribution to our public debate. Election 2010. It's unresolved. We almost certainly face a minority government. The contest has moved from the community to the parliament. There's no guarantee that we'll see a stable government formed, and the issue may have to be resolved at some stage with a second election. I think we need to see this election in perspective. In 2007-08, Kevin Rudd and the Labor caucus believed they would enjoy at least two terms in office, a view only reinforced by mid-2009 when Australia had clearly survived the global financial crisis. The idea that Julia Gillard might lead the Labor government into the next election and lose Labor's majority would have been regarded as utterly inconceivable. And from the Liberal point of view, looking at 2007-2008, facing internal disunity, chronic leadership problems, a further swing to the Labor Party, the idea that at the next election, the coalition would have been competing with Labor to form a minority government would have been even more inconceivable. Now, I make these two historical points to emphasise, first, that this election represents a major failure on the part of the Labor Party. It's the worst result for a first-term government since Scullin in the 1930s, which was obviously shaped by the Great Depression. Whitlam won a second term in 1974, clearly. Hawke won four elections, and Keating was re-elected Prime Minister after getting the job from the caucus. In my view, this election result is because of deep-seated problems in the Labor Party. The Rudd government did well handling the global financial crisis, yet its overall record in policy and political terms was weak and disappointing. There are two pivotal points in the last term. The first was the caucus overthrow of Rudd as Prime Minister. This was a vote of no confidence by the Labor Party in its own Prime Minister. And from this point, the party struggled to persuade the people not to make a judgment on the Labor government that the party itself had already made. I think Julia Gillard campaigned as a formidable warrior. She was effective, she was fluent, she was prime ministerial. She did all and more that the party could have expected. I doubt that Kevin Rudd would have done as well as Gillard. Yet Gillard could not surmount the difficult situation she inherited or that she chose for herself when she decided to challenge Rudd. The second pivotal factor was a surprise to many. Tony Abbott emerged as the best option as Liberal leader. He campaigned effectively, and the coalition looked most of the time to be a credible alternative government. Abbott, to a considerable extent, evolved as a political figure during this campaign. He was no longer the romantic attached to fading causes. He was disciplined. He changed his position on a number of issues. He was able to keep the party united, and he put the heat on Labor. His message to Labor was, well, Labor's got to win. The coalition won't surrender this election to you. I think the key to Labor's poor result lies in strategic factors, and in particular the poor performance of the Rudd government. Now, I won't go into this in detail, I just say this. Rudd eventually was removed because of four really important reasons. The first one was the political standing of the Rudd government had collapsed, and he triggered the survival instinct inside the Labor caucus. Second, the Rudd government was largely a dysfunctional government. This went to a failure of people management, and also, I think, a character failure on Rudd's part in terms of the way he ran the government. When his position collapsed in the polls, he had nothing else to fall back on, no sense of personal or tribal loyalty. The third factor was there was an alternative waiting in the wings. Julia Gillard was seen as the alternative leader by all factions of the Labor Party. And finally, Rudd had made a series of policy mistakes. His retreat on climate change in April 2010 was the single worst decision he made. It cancelled his governing credentials as a leader of conviction. He never got his policy right on the boats. And finally, he broke every rule in the book in introducing the mining tax. The mining tax was the final straw. I think Rudd would have survived as Prime Minister if he hadn't tried to introduce the mining tax. So we saw a change of Prime Minister. I think the change of Prime Minister by the caucus was justified, but I think the way it was done was dangerously flawed. And I want to identify some of these flaws, and I make the point that some of these points are judgments in retrospect. First, Rudd should have been locked in. He was discarded. He was left by himself. He was consigned to the backbench with all the instability involved in that. He should have been locked in, and he should have had a senior cabinet position. Secondly, Gillard's approach was to fix and run after she became Prime Minister. That is, she was going to fix the three problem areas, the mining tax, the boats and climate change, and then run to an election. This didn't work out. If the Labor government's crisis was so deep, then it required more substantive policy changes to address. This was overlooked. The view of the apparatchiks was that the Gillard personality would do the job. One of the problems is that Gillard never outlined her own agenda as Prime Minister for the next term. She was essentially running on Kevin Rudd's agenda, the agenda that hadn't worked. The one big idea she had for herself, the idea of a sustainable Australia or a smaller Australia, I think judged from the election result, was quite equivocal. To a certain extent it worked, as indicated by the polls, yet there were other electorates where there were migrant populations that seemed to have a sense of reservation about this idea. Gillard, like Rudd, was able to do nothing with the central strategic problem. Labor was left fighting on two fronts. The Greens were formidable, and the Abbott reignited coalition was formidable. I think, as ever, the Labor Party underestimated Abbott. So let me make a few points about the coalition. Abbott came to the leadership of the Liberal Party in late last year with two great insights. The first was obvious, and that is the only way the conservative side of politics could be united was by opposing the ETS. This was an absolutely fundamental judgment that proved to be right. Malcolm Turnbull's difficulty, regardless of the merit of his position, was it meant a divided conservative force that would have no chance at an election. The second insight that Abbott had was that if you attacked Rudd from the right and put him under a lot of pressure rather than tried to meet him in the middle ground, if you attacked him from the right, he would falter and start to melt. And once again, this is exactly what happened. The point I'd make about Labor's attitude towards Abbott is it was always ambivalent. They had little regard for Abbott. To a very considerable extent, they thought he was unelectable, yet they were also intimidated by him. And they were intimidated out of calling an early 2010 election on the ETS, an election that Labor probably could have won because they were frightened of Abbott's campaign on the great big new carbon tax. Then Labor made another blunder. Having fallen victim to Abbott's campaign on the carbon tax, they gave him the chance to have another go. They introduced a mining tax, completely underestimating the extent to which Abbott and the mining industry would be able to exploit this as an issue. If we look at the result, I think in many ways it is a result with the country divided into three groups. Labor has done very badly in the big resource states of Queensland and the West. The Labor primary vote in the West is under 32%. In Queensland, it's down to 34%. These are shocking votes. So I think Labor's got a real problem in the big pro-growth resource states. And this is a function of its position on both the ETS and the mining tax. Secondly, there is part of Australia which is pro-Gillard and likes the idea of a Gillard prime ministership. The two-party preferred vote in Victoria for Labor was 55%, in Tasmania 60%, in South Australia 53%, and in the ACT 62%. So Gillard has done very well in that part of the country. Finally, New South Wales. New South Wales was to a certain extent equivocal. Very strong swing against Labor in New South Wales, but it looks like the Liberals have only won 4 seats. They should have won more seats. Bad Liberal Party campaigns on the ground in certain seats in New South Wales have cost Abbott the Prime Ministership. The Liberals, given the overall swing, should have done better in New South Wales. Final lessons. Well, we've seen in this election campaign the rise of the brand. The Labor brand is contaminated in Queensland and New South Wales because of the performance of state Labor governments, and this raises all sorts of interesting issues about the future interaction between Commonwealth elections and state government performance. The rise of the Greens, 9 senators plus 1 member of the House, a vote in the reps of 11% overall. The Greens have arrived with greater power and responsibility they've ever had before. There is a clear lesson. They need to be scrutinised properly by the media as a force in their own right and no longer given the free ride which they've had over the last 3 years. The Greens represent a fundamental problem for Labor. They are Labor's ally and they are Labor's enemy. And Labor faces a very difficult reconciliation and competition with the Greens on the centre-left of politics. Finally, as I said at the start, it's by no means clear to me that we can establish an effective government. These three independents now are under great pressure and they've got to go with one party or the other. The independents, despite all the nonsense and humbug they go on with, have got to go with either Gillard or with Tony Abbott. My last point is, is this a poison chalice for whoever becomes Prime Minister? A Prime Minister in a minority government facing a very difficult situation. If Gillard gets there, lots of tensions inside the party, having to incorporate Rudd back into her government, being reliant upon the Greens and the Independents. If Abbott gets there, he's got a front bench which doesn't look particularly strong and a hostile Senate. So might it be a poison chalice election? Thank you very much.
This is my fault. I asked for a PowerPoint display and then I couldn't come up with the goods, so sorry about that. That's why we don't have any images. So thank you very much to the Sydney Institute for having me. I'd like to pass on apologies from Senator Mark R. Bibb, who would have loved to have been here, but has been ordered by the Prime Minister to go back to his focus groups and ask if, given we'll be having another election soon, the next Labor leader should be Julia Gillard, Mark Latham, Wilson Tuckey, Wyatt Roy, or back to Kevin Rudd. Like you, I'm thrilled the election is over and delighted the ride doesn't seem to be slowing down at all. I spent much of the past 5 weeks in the campaign bubble with Julia Gillard and Tony Abbott. I suspect that makes me less qualified than most of you to conduct this autopsy, but the corpse is on the slab and I'm prepared to scrub in and start up my bone saw. I'll venture a few thoughts and then offer up some of the more baffling moments from life on the campaign buses, and I'd love to know if you guys can make sense of them. So what just happened? I think it was an election that showed us our nation at a time of massive technological and social change, where the principal mood was not left or right, anger or hope, but irritated confusion. Julia Gillard said on Saturday night, the electorate had spoken, but we didn't know what they'd said yet. I don't know about that. I think they said a few things loud and clear. They said two-party preferred is now a contradiction in terms. They said that Tony guy seems pretty crazy, but at least he's crazy brave. They said, we really like Julia, but will she really be Prime Minister if we vote for her? And then will she be real Julia PM? Will she wear those pearls every day for the rest of her term? Are they real pearls? The voters also said, you know, this Mark Latham seems to make a lot of sense. Politicians really are duplicitous, backstabbing attention grabbers who never saw a microphone they didn't like. And most loudly of all, I think they said, Kevin Rudd might have been a pain in the backside, but he was our pain in the backside and we wanted to kick it ourselves. But then we did many things differently in election 2010. Normally, Australians vote not in winter, but in summer, when the politicians think we're more likely to be in a good mood. Normally, we don't consult our telephones for voting advice. Women are strictly for ornamental purposes. Ex-prime ministers retreat to their farms. Faceless men are anonymous and do not blog. Leaders remain fully clothed at all times, and we might shout at our TVs, but we don't try and send messages to them. Hair and exercise and jewellery and boyfriends, emoticons and earlobes and swimsuits, meat pies and wrinkles, ducks and bulldozers and toads, these are the images of strange, strained election 2010. We learnt freshly negative connotations for some words, great and big and new, were all suddenly bad things. There were some new positive terms too, ranger, lame, churchy, loser and dead, buried and cremated. The past was more important than the future. God stayed out of the way. Marriage was a dark and dangerous topic. A year ago, nobody expected election 2010 to be interesting. No first-term government had been ditched since the Great Depression, everyone seemed to like Kevin Rudd, and the opposition was playing quietly in its bedroom, tearing the wings off leaders, one after another. Then, suddenly, we had a death match. We knew them both pretty well already. We knew their skill, their likability, and their vicious flirtation. Both were British-born, and both as Australian as rising inflections and budgie smugglers. He called her Fake Julia. She called him Mr. Rabbit. It was, I think, the bonsai campaign, where for most of the time the parties tried to keep their leaders as small as possible, clipped and confined, warm and well-watered, out of the way of anything unexpected or undecided. There was an extraordinary amount of posturing about budgets, debt and deficit in this election when fiscal rectitude seemed to become the new family values. But neither party seemed able to read its own human balance sheet. Labor had an enormous asset in Julia Gillard, who is warm and fun and clever, but just as they failed to capitalise on the rest of their assets, Labor managed to turn Ms Gillard into just another liability. The Liberals had a massive liability in Tony Abbott, the unpredictable street fighter who talked too much, too loudly, about too many things. They turned him into their greatest asset. Again, quite a feat. And this is one of the big contradictions of this election. We started the campaign assuming it was Tony Abbott who had a woman problem. In fact, I think it was Julia Gillard. Early in the campaign, the Prime Minister was on the cover of the Australian Women's Weekly in glamorous pantsuits and pearls. She looked stunning and impeccably groomed, and I think that turned out to be a bad thing for Labor. From the first day of the campaign, the party failed to notice a huge potential problem on Ms Gillard's radar. The fact that many women were not so much overcome by feminist pride in her achievements, but instead filled with a particularly female form of savagery. Call it jealousy, call it spite. Anyone who's worked in an all-female environment or been to a girls' school knows women can be brutal with each other. Hair, body, intellect, face, voice, accent, they're all open to scrutiny and criticism. And from Ms Gillard's first day as PM, the feminine whispers began. Backstabber, bitch, liar. In this campaign, they were words I heard mainly from women. At polling booths, in malls, in cafes. On Friday night, just gone, I was at Penrith Panthers Leagues Club waiting for Ms Gillard near a group of curious local women. They didn't smile or wave when the PM came in. They muttered, "Mole," and turned away. The campaign's most savage media commentary came, indeed, from women. And I think it was no accident that the Liberal Party's advertisements used a female voice artist to read the line, "If Kevin Rudd can't trust Julia Gillard, how on earth can we?" It's a depressing truth of modern Australia that many women are very quick to knock one another down. I think it's the same sentiment that fuels the sale of nasty gossip magazines. Many Australian women simply don't trust one another. In this case, I think pearls and lip gloss in the Women's Weekly did not help soften or placate the women who suspected Ms Gillard had tickets to her own show. A better strategic look might have been Julia at home, minus the jewellery, wearing jeans and a T-shirt, chatting to her niece or having coffee in Altona with Tim, and might have given the female public a better view of the real Julia, who, as Paul and Peter might agree, is a down-to-earth person. Those women at Penrith Panthers might have thought so too if Gillard had chatted with them, for she's charming and genuine in person. Indeed, she relishes the chance to win over a sceptic, as she showed on the occasions when she really shone during the campaign, such as the Q&A program in week 3. Even after the shift to real Julia at the end of week 2, I was surprised by Labor's failure to get Gillard out among ordinary people. On the Saturday, 1 week before election day, the PM, followed by a plane load of media, including me, awoke before dawn in Melbourne, flew to Ballina, drove halfway to Lismore, spent 45 minutes on a farm owned by the New South Wales Department of Agriculture, where a climate change announcement of little note was made, then drove back to Ballina and flew back to Melbourne. She did not meet any voters, apart from the departmental staff and journalists, if we count. That was a typical day throughout a campaign where Labor staged events far from the people, as if they feared that Julia Gillard needed to be shielded. On election day itself, with just 10 hours to grab as many last wavering voters as possible, Julia Gillard awoke in her Penrith hotel room, drove to the Nepean River for a live cross to the Sunrise program, had coffee with local candidate David Bradbury, then flew to Melbourne, voted at a primary school, and retired to another hotel, the Hilton. She didn't hand out a single how-to-vote card. She visited no marginal polling booths. She made no stump speech. She shook a maximum of 20 hands. It was just hours after Tony Abbott had completed his 36-hour insomnia attack when he was startling cops and sleepy radio hosts on the graveyard shift by appearing in their midst to talk about stopping the boats, paying back the debt, cutting the great big new taxes and ending the waste, the mantra we can all now say in our sleep. But even with the doomsday clock ticking, Labor didn't display any sense of urgency or any confidence that their leader was an asset worth showing off. So what about Tony Abbott? A clever friend of mine, Chris Nishi from the Australian Financial Review, came up with a great observation that the Liberals' own faceless men had told Mr Abbott to wear a suit and tie every day, all day, on the assumption that if he was in a suit and tie, he couldn't do anything undignified, like, say, playing tennis or wielding tasers or filleting fish. Turns out Mr Abbott can do just about anything in a suit. He tried very hard to stay in his box, however. In week three of the campaign, Mr Abbott was campaigning at a southeast Queensland garden centre and petting zoo, accompanied by me and Peter, among others. Suddenly, in a perfect addition to the campaign's air of Tony in Wonderland, a miniature horse came trotting in from stage left. The horse, whose name was Slushy, and who was about as high as your hip, swished his pink dyed mane joyfully, ready to pose for pictures with the Leader of the Opposition. You can imagine how excited the photographers and cameramen were, but the Liberal campaign team weren't having it for a second. The Federal Police at the gate murmured with the media advisers and the advance team, and Slushy was led away. When a pet duck appeared at a nursing home visit the previous week, Mr Abbott regarded it like a hand grenade, deadly at close range, and backed away. The message from Liberal campaign headquarters was clear. You are the alternative, Prime Minister. Act like it. And Mr Abbott, whose gangly air adds a sense of overhanging doom to every moment, did manage, with a few exceptions, to maintain an air of gravitas. At a Chinese community dinner in Chatswood one evening, John Howard introduced Mr Abbott. It's catching. To a rapturous crowd as our next PM. He strode to the stage, all cockiness and power, the real Tony the party had been trying to hide. He was enthusiastic and vital. He was shouting too loudly. As he began to speak, a banner fell from the wall behind him and Mr Abbott became even more excited. He shouted that the falling poster was an auspicious sign in the Chinese calendar. It means that this is no longer a Liberal Chinese community dinner. This is a dinner which is going to storm the country and transform our country. Phrases like storm the country are enough to make campaign advisers like Tony O'Leary choke on their dim sims. And you might have noticed that Mr Abbott never said it again and never again allowed his excitement to carry him away quite so loudly. With my colleague Simon Carney, I interviewed Mr Abbott at the end of week four. It was the first campaign interview featuring his wife and daughters, who sat at a cafe table with us, drinking coffee and talking about their charming, embarrassing, verbose dad. Bridgie, baby, he kept calling youngest daughter Bridget. Margie, darling, angel, sweetheart, he welcomed his wife when she walked in. His 21-year-old daughter Louise, or Lulu Angel, as Mr Abbott calls her, told us Dad was the soft touch in the family, who left all the discipline to Mrs Abbott and just wanted to be liked. The women in Abbott's life said they were baffled that this affectionate, exuberant man could have a woman problem. And by campaign's end, I think it had gone, precisely because he wasn't allowed to say anything like that in public. The Liberals' carefully calibrated parental leave policy, the suit and tie small target trick, and perhaps a muzzle on all talk of virginity, helped Mr Abbott neutralise the gender risk and helped voters see that underneath the quirks and beyond the more outlandish policy positions, he is, at a human level, as genuine and decent as Julia Gillard. On Saturday night, I was in the Labor celebration at Melbourne's Convention Centre, where the balloons were deflating before the champagne was served, and the word party was not to be whispered. The big signs welcoming supporters to the room simply declared Australian Labor, as if the P word would bring on karmic collapse. That might have been part of the problem. Labor didn't seem to know how to celebrate itself, its achievements, or its leader, which I think was a shame. While we waited for Julia Gillard to come on stage about 11 p.m, three female Labor supporters standing behind me saw ABC journalist Lee Sales flash up on the big screen as part of the ABC broadcast. Tory witch, one of them said. Terrible suit, said another. It was the woman problem in extreme close-up, and it wasn't very encouraging. To be fair, those words were spoken at the end of a long, tearful night filled with salty snacks and warm Chardonnay. It was a very bad night for Labor, and I suspect there were many more bad nights and unfair attacks to come. And I don't know if Julia Gillard could ever have defeated that particular sentiment or how much it harmed her vote. I'd love to know what you think.
Well, thanks, Claire. That was very good. It was a reminder of that this was actually a pretty funny campaign. A campaign that I think is the funniest I can remember. But a campaign where the bloke promising to bring us grown-up government finished the campaign by pulling an all-nighter in the pubs of Sydney. and where we had a Labor campaign where you didn't know who was going to bob up next, the ghost of Kevin Rudd, angry and bitter, or the ghost of Mark Latham, angry and bitter. It was a very funny campaign. And on the face of it, well, we were coming, as you said, Claire, we were coming tonight to conduct a post-mortem, but it turns out the bloody thing is still alive, and we're going to conduct a vivisection. But let's take the whole contest on face value. On face value, a visitor from another country or from Mars might have turned up and looked at the two leaders on offer and said, "My goodness, this is going to be an electrifying contest, a great clash of worldviews." On the one hand, we have one party led by a man who's a conservative, right-wing Catholic who used to lead used to be Australia's chief monarchist, an avowed anti-abortionist and family man. And the other party, led by a woman with her roots in the Victorian socialist left, who'd worked as a lawyer for the union movement, who was a declared atheist, living childless in a de facto relationship. What two clashing worldviews these people represent. But of course, that visitor from Mars or foreigner would have been completely wrong, wouldn't they? Because once you take the leaders and process them through the systems of machine politics and parliamentary, that great sort of winnowing effect of parliamentary clash, you ended up with a great sort of homogenisation of the offerings. For example, was Julia Gillard, the atheist, planning to take any funding away from religious schools and distribute it to public schools? No, of course not. Was Tony Abbott, the anti-abortionist, planning any change to access to abortion in Australia? No, of course not. So, as with the leaders, we also saw, I think, a great homogenisation of the parties and their politics, and I think a great retreat from reform ambition in Australian politics, particularly compared to just a few years ago. We had sort of high points of ambition and reform ambition under John Howard on the one side and Kevin Rudd on the other. But the trauma that both parties received, I think, the trauma that the Liberals had when Work Choices was such a dismal failure politically, and when the trauma that the Labor Party suffered when they retreated, cowed, beaten and uncomprehending from their attempt to deal with climate change, left both parties suffering a reform underachievement trauma, RUT. We were stuck in a rut, I think. And as a consequence, we saw both parties abandoning policy agendas which were central to their DNA. The Liberals, the great party of deregulating labour, vowing not to touch labour laws. The Labour Party, which just 3 years earlier had been elected primarily to deal with the problem of climate change, running away from climate change as fast as it possibly could. We saw a contest not between two political lions at this election, but between two political mice. Even some of the big outstanding issues that we thought might have been dealt with at this campaign were actually settled by a sort of political osmosis and bipartisan consensus reached to take them off the table before the election. Specifically, I mean big Australia, immigration. Before the election campaign even started, both parties had agreed that this was what we did as a country was effectively dump half a century of bipartisan consensus in favour of big Australia and in favour of a large immigration intake. By the time Julia Gillard called the election, this was a subject that dare not speak its name. Both parties were signalling frantically that they would cut population growth, cut immigration, and do whatever it took to kill off the concept of big Australia. Both parties had avowed to sign up for paid parental leave, two different systems, two different proposals, but both concurring that the social reform, which all industrialised countries except the US and Australia had enshrined, now had to be enshrined here as well. That was also a matter of agreement by the time Election Day rolled around. And another consensus item too was, I think, an extraordinary piece of self-restraint, fiscal discipline, both parties agreeing for the first time in our federated history, no net new spending during an election campaign. And, of course, bipartisan consensus to pay off the deficit as quickly as possible. So where did that leave for the campaign to settle? Well, there wasn't a lot in the way of big, outstanding difference for the campaign to sort through. What were we left with? A couple of things stand out. The fairly stark difference on a national broadband network, how to deal with wiring the country for the internet, and second, the mining tax. These were the two standout issues that were left. The parties had either run away from everything else or come up with a bipartisan consensus instead. So what we were left with, in my view, was rather than government, an incumbent government and an opposition, I think we were left with two oppositions. Tony Abbott had been planning to campaign for a protest vote against Kevin Rudd, but of course Julia Gillard got there first. She was the one marshalling a protest vote against Kevin Rudd and doing it suddenly from the position of the Prime Ministership. The voters rejected Labor, as we've just seen. There was a swing against Labor in the primary vote of 4.9% on the 75% of votes so far counted. So that's a fairly clear, that's one of the biggest swings since 1949. That's a pretty clear repudiation of Labor. But the voters didn't embrace the coalition either. The coalition's primary vote at the moment has gained only 0.6 of a percentage point. So Labor loses 5, the coalition picks up 0.6 on the primary vote. Now, my interpretation of that is that we've certainly rejected Labor, but we haven't embraced the coalition either. Perhaps we were looking for a government, and as a result rejected both of the oppositions on offer. So the voters have refused to settle the question and left it to the independents instead. They're meeting as we are meeting at this particular moment, the three independents, the three so-called former national independents, also known as the regional independents, or as the London Telegraph called them last night, the haystack amigos, are meeting in Canberra as we speak to decide their sort of en bloc approach to the negotiations. You'll note they're not entering into it with any great haste. They are waiting to see how the final seat count falls to decide the alignment of power on both sides, because at the moment, best guess you'd have to say would be 72 seats to 72 seats, maybe 73. So it's a very tight finish. Now, we've heard a lot that this is a terrible outcome. We've heard that this is the death of strong and stable government. Yet when the financial markets opened yesterday, I think we saw there a sort of a reasonably apolitical arbiter decided that there wasn't really much damage at all. In fact, precisely nothing happened when the markets opened yesterday. Absolutely nothing happened on the stock market, and a little less than that happened on the foreign exchange market. There was a little more movement today, but it's hard to suggest that the panic that was absent yesterday would suddenly turn up today. So the financial markets, I suggest, concur with my judgment that it was a low-stakes election, and the outcome need not be so terrible. And here's why. Two thoughts. In the last few days, we've seen a sudden switch in the agenda items under discussion in our national polity. Have you heard anything about boat people in the last couple of days? No. Have we heard anything about the debt in the last couple of days? No. Now, these are both real issues and real problems, but were hyperinflated through the hyperbole of political campaigning to become the giant national crises that they evidently are not. A country with a 6% of GDP peak debt
when the entire industrialised world is running peaked out of over 90% of GDP, is clearly not a major front row casualty of the sovereign debt crisis. So what do we hear now as the foremost items on the national political agenda? Well, we hear about water. We hear about health. We hear about communications and broadband. We hear about climate change. And we hear about an agenda for good governance. I would put it to you that all and any of these actually are larger, more pressing and more real-world central problems for our country than the ones which came to dominate much of the campaign discourse. The second thought about why this isn't necessarily such a shocking outcome is that the one item or agenda item that the independents so far can agree on, where they concur, is that they all want to see improvements to good governance in our federal system. The sorts of changes that the big political parties, comfortable with the status quo, never rush to make. Sorts of changes that we have seen imposed by independents in state governments, we've seen imposed in New South Wales and Victoria and other states by governments that have, minority governments that have depended on independents. They are strengthening the powers of auditors general, strengthening the powers of ombudsmen, cleaning up political donations regimes, changes to question time. These, I would suggest to you, all sound like pretty good and useful agenda items in pursuit of better governance. There was there is an extremely good chance that we will, as I think Paul said, end up in the weeks or months ahead at a second election. There's a pretty good chance that this process will not end in a clear, stable governing agreement, and we'll all be back at the polls. The only precedent we have in federal politics, 1940, when the Menzies government was able to win with a minority government that was able to win over the support of two independents, was a government that lasted only 12 months before collapsing, and that may be the precedent. But when I put this to Julia Gillard on Monday, she said, well, maybe, but the precedent that I'm looking at, she said, is the precedent of the Bracks government in Victoria, which managed a full four-year term. It was fairly stable. It managed improvements to governance. In New South Wales, the equivalent was Greiner and Fay. And once again, I don't think anybody would look back on that and say that that was a time in either state of terrible crisis. So the independents are meeting right now in between the Australian Electoral Commission and the Haystack Amigos, so-called. Our national future is in the balance. We'll find out soon enough. Thanks.
Well, many thanks to our speakers for three great papers. Thanks also to Mellisons for making this facility possible to the Sydney Institute tonight. And, of course, our talks here tonight will be up on our podcast sometime tomorrow and will be published in the Sydney papers online in due course. So we come to questions and discussion. We'll probably go till about 7:15. There are a lot of people here. We've got three speakers, so I think it's best if you direct your question or comment to one speaker. I think I'll get our three speakers to come up here and just stand around, and I'll stand over there and just talk into the microphone. And so questions, discussion. So we go down the back and then we come over here. Yep. Oh, hang on, we've got a podcast, so Ren, right... I'm sorry, we have a microphone, yeah. It's been a... yeah. Oh, you got one. Oh, okay, sorry. Okay, here we go.
Thank you for very interesting talks. Given the fact that there's only a 0.6% swing to the coalition, and given I understand that in the Senate, Labor's lost one as compared to coalition losing three seats, does that mean that there's a chance for Malcolm Turnbull again?
Well, who wants to take that? Say, perhaps Paul.
Yeah. I would have thought Tony Abbott's performance in this campaign, which exceeded expectations on the part of his own side and on the part of the Labor Party, means that he's in a very good position to remain leader. If he becomes Prime Minister, that goes without question. If Gillard becomes Prime Minister, I think Abbott will remain opposition leader. And I think the problem that Malcolm Turnbull faced and would face is the difficulty that he would have uniting the party.
Karen, there's a question here. Yeah.
Thank you all for a very interesting discussion. I'm hearing from Peter that there's been a natural phenomenon happened here. For the first time, I think we've seen the blending of red and blue and come out with beige. And when it comes to the Senate, we've seen a clashing of red and blue and come out with green. What I found striking about this particular campaign was that there seemed to be a concerted effort to exclude the Greens from the debates and from a lot of the discussions. And in fact, it wasn't a two-way contest. It was actually a three-way contest. If we are looking now at a new process in government, how might that look? And how might we, in future campaigns, acknowledge that there are more than two parties involved?
Peter, if you come up to here and take it from the microphone, okay.
Well, you're right, of course. The Greens leader was denied a stand in the televised debate. The Greens were denied a stand in almost anything where the two parties had a chance to shut them out. The one debate that did occur with the Greens at the podium was actually in the National Press Club debate on the broadband future and future of communications. I don't know if any of you saw it, but the Green spokesman actually added a great deal. He was articulate, intelligent, and held both the others to scrutiny. So I thought where they were allowed a role, they actually discharged themselves pretty well. The voters, however, didn't seem to mind and voted the Greens are a huge and unequivocal winner from this process. What does it mean in the Senate? Well, the Greens now have a great... what does it mean for legislative outcomes? The Greens have a great opportunity. If they can deal with this new power responsibly and reasonably, and as Bob Brown keeps promising, constructively, he promises to improve legislation in the Senate rather than to operate as a bloody-minded oppositionist, then they could build support for the next election. But if is as more likely in the history of minor parties, they suffer from excessive expectations, the sort of vehemence of a small party room with lots of expectations, a lot of new players, and the pressures that the inherent strictures of a parliamentary system impose, they're more likely to fracture and embarrass themselves. So, but it's entirely up to them now whether they can discharge their new opportunity. But in all likelihood, it means that we're going to see, with the deadlock in the lower house and the balance of power with the Greens in the upper house, it's a great recipe for doing absolutely nothing and a tremendous state of deadlock. But then if you look at the election outcome, maybe that's what Australians want.
There's a question over there.
Peter referred to the knife edge 1940 election. After Menzies stepped down 12 months later, Fanon then took over, and the two independents who initially blackmailed him, asking for a ministry, Fanon refused to hand it over to Labor. Given that there were only two independents then, and according to the AEC this afternoon, we effectively have five and a half or six here, is there any reasonable prospect at all that we could have a stable government without another election?
So, Claire, do you want to tackle that? Can we have a stable government without a new election? That's the question.
Well, I think Australia's pretty unusual in Western democracies for never having gone down this path in a concerted way until now. You know, there are plenty of Western democracies who make coalition governments work all the time, and they work quite well, and I think they probably end up with a more diverse range of voices in the parliament. In relation to the point about the Greens earlier, I think the Greens campaign this year showed that you probably don't need to be in the big debates at Rutte Hill, RSL or wherever to do well. You know, both the leaders were spent a lot of time arguing about whether there were debates to be had, and Bob Brown was complaining that he couldn't get a voice in those debates. But there was nothing stopping any of them, including Bob Brown, from holding a town hall forum every single night of the week, or, you know, standing up and making a stump speech, like we've seen even in the past 20 years, plenty of leaders do. I thought one of the more disappointing features of this campaign was that there was that real kind of dualism, and, as you say, the Greens were excluded, but I think the parties could probably take a bit of control of that themselves if they wanted to really engage with people.
Perhaps I was following on the question I asked Paul, because you made comments about the Greens in the media. Seems to me, if you're on the ABC, I mean, the only soft interviews are for Greens politicians. Labour and the Coalition get... I mean, Kevin Rudd and then Julie Gillard and Tony Abbott got pretty tough interviews. Bob Brown tend to get very soft interviews. So when you talk about the media needs to be... to scrutinise the Greens more, what do you have in mind in greater detail there?
Well, I could give you one classic example. I have a very different take on the history of the last 18 months. Kevin Rudd, I think, was essentially destroyed and lost the Prime Ministership as a result of events originating in the failure to pass his carbon pollution reduction scheme through the Parliament. Now, Tony Abbott opposed it, but the Greens opposed it. And the reason we don't have a carbon pollution reduction scheme and a price on carbon today is not just because of the Liberal Party, it's because of the Greens. And the Greens have been just as cynical and just as tough and just as ruthless as the Tony Abbott Liberal Party. In fact, if they'd given passage to the bills with the appropriate defectors they would have got from the Coalition side, Kevin Rudd would be Prime Minister today, although the Green vote last weekend would not have been as high as it otherwise was. So I guess what I'd say in response to Gerard's question is, if you look at the scrutiny applied to Kevin Rudd, Julie Gillard and Tony Abbott on emissions trading and on a carbon price, and then the lack of scrutiny applied to the Greens, Q&A was a classic example last night. We had the discussion essentially the whole night about climate change policy. We had a Green politician there, and they were never asked the obvious question. Why did the Greens vote down a carbon price and destroy the Rudd-Wong legislation, leading essentially to the demise of Kevin Rudd as Prime Minister? I would have thought these are fairly relevant questions to justify an awful lot of scrutiny. So I think that's one example that I would put forward. But, I mean, essentially there's very little scrutiny applied to the Green agenda, and it's an extremely radical agenda. I think the media, given this election result and the performance of the Greens, needs to actually apply some media professionalism when it comes to their questioning of Green politicians and their scrutiny of Green policies.
So did you want to add to that, or are you okay?
I'd just add the question that the Greens weren't asked then. Bob Brown was asked at his final appearance at the National Press Club, and I thought the answer was very interesting, because it's not the answer that that you might expect. Bob Brown was asked there about why the Greens, if they really cared about climate change and really wanted to start addressing carbon emissions, why they did, as Paul just pointed out, participate in the blocking of the Rudd plan for an emissions trading scheme. Now, Bob Brown's answer was not based on climate change and not based on climate science. His answer was because we objected to the compensation, and this is as nearly as I can remember it, his verbatim answer, because we objected to the compensation under the bill that would have flowed from the pockets of taxpayers into the pockets of the biggest polluters. So, in other words, his objection was not a climate-based objection. His objection was a redistributive objection. And at that, in that same appearance at the National Press Club, Bob Brown made very clear that all the party's taxation policies, which are essentially redistributive, were not dead letters in the party platform, like Labor's old commitment to socialise the economy was a dead letter, but were live tenets that they would work hard to enshrine. Now, if that's how they want to pitch themselves, I think that's fine. Pitch themselves as what Brown clearly offered himself as on that day. That is the progressive party that the Labor Party once was and is no longer. The Greens want to fill that slot in Australian political life. But there is a misnomer and a misunderstanding that they are all about climate and environment. What Brown signalled that day was that, although that may be true, above and beyond climate issues and environmental issues are questions of wealth redistribution, and that's what they're really about. I thought that was very revealing.
Okay, so we've got a lot of questions. We'll go back to one. There's a question here.
I guess it could be to Peter or to Paul. I guess a lot of people have asked about a second election. How would that work exactly? Is there a sort of time period by which we have to have it, and would the candidates be the same, and would there be a campaign period as well? And if so, isn't that a bit of a national nightmare?
Well, it's a good question, but the answer is impossible because we don't know what the settlement is. We don't know who's going to be Prime Minister. All I can say about the situation is the only way we can even approach a tenable form of stable government is for there to be a formal written agreement between the minority government and a group of independents prepared to support it on confidence and supply. An agreement which has got to be transparent, public, which has got to document the cost of any new programs agreed to by the government as a result of the price for stability. A related question is how many independents would be prepared to sign up to this? These independents do have different positions, and we're gradually becoming aware of this listening to the fairly extraordinary comments from them over the last couple of days. So can they agree collectively to enter into such an agreement? What concessions might Gillard or Abbott be prepared to offer? Because they need to be very careful as Prime Ministers in terms of maintaining their own authority and integrity and avoiding giving too much away. All sides will want to try and maintain an agreement because having entered into it, they would not likely to concede failure quickly, which would mean another election. But the reality is this is going to be incredibly difficult. It's very tight. It's going to be a minority government. There are going to be a number of independents involved. And the real problem for Australia is not that we might face some crisis in policy terms or a loss of confidence in the government or some collapse in the market. The real problem is a slow decline in the quality of policy. The real problem is incrementalism and a gradual deterioration in the quality of public policy and a loss of momentum. And frankly, we can't afford that in today's world.
We'll go with Glenn. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that...
Hang on, who's this to, Glenn? Who's it to?
Oh, it's Claire.
Declare, okay.
So I think there's some interesting common possibilities in the various combinations which are being discussed. One which appealed to me was the idea of having the coalition working together with the country independents, and then with Kevin Rudd as independent Speaker of the Parliament. Another one was the idea of that party working together with the country independents and also with Andrew Wilkie and maybe the Green. And I thought the possibility of Bob Catter and Andrew Wilkie and the Green having to work together was a rather interesting idea.
Glenn, you're in the wrong function. You should be down at the meeting in Canberra. Okay.
Yeah. As Paul says, you could always make Bob Catter foreign minister. Foreign minister is often the job that you give to the person who you most want to go away. So... Yeah, I think there are all sorts of possible permutations, and I think Paul's right that there will end up being an agreement on confidence and supply, and everything else will be a bun fight, and it'll be fascinating to see how long that can possibly last. If we are to go to another election, we may end up with a very different result, and it may not be that one party just pushes a little over the line. I think there were polls throughout the campaign showing that even people who were planning to vote against Julia Gillard thought that Julia Gillard was going to win. And so there may have been a lot of people out there who either voted one way or the other, expecting that it would be a landslide the other way, and felt that they could have a protest vote and get away with it. And that was the message that both the parties were pushing very hard in the last couple of days. So I think we'll probably have to declare a conflict of interest too, although we're all obviously very interested in good governance and stability. It will be a lot more fun if we do have 5 independents in the House of Representatives and they have a fight about everything. So
we go Anne, Anya, Robin. Okay, we've got to be quick.
Okay. I'm not sure who wants to answer this, but anyone who's about 90 years of age will remember that this sort of thing used to happen a lot in the 30s and 40s. I think in 43, after a hung parliament or whatever, there was a huge swing to the Labor Party and had a massive win. But checks and balances are huge in this, and we've had governments for a long time who haven't had the 99% and we're going back to the DLP, whatever. And most legislation gets through because Liberal and Labor stay together. And in these, you've been in the campaign, Claire, others have got different views. We've got these three turkeys. They're a bit like Ali Baba outside the cave, ready to load up the camels at the moment. What do we know about them? What will these checks and balances really in the end come down to? We don't really want to risk the next election because the National Party may ride in and take our seats. I mean, can you tell us a little bit about how you think the checks and balances will work on the independents?
So the question is, what are the pressures or the checks and balances on, at the moment, the three independents?
Well, I don't think any of them regard themselves as beholden to very much of anything, really. I think they would consider themselves as having been elected to represent their electorates, and that's it. And they're all, I think, very conscious that whichever way they go, they'll be punished by the people who voted for them. I think that's the primary concern for all of them. I think people in Rob Oakeshott's electorate will be angry whichever way he goes, and he'll have to fight very hard to hold that seat the next time around if he goes with either major party. I don't know that. I think the success of the three of them has shown that there's a real hunger, particularly in rural Australia, for a voice that's different from the National Party. I think there's a hunger for a party that is the party of the bush, that speaks about things like broadband and water and environmental management in modern ways. And I don't think people are feeling that they're getting that from the Nationals. Bob Brown, incidentally, pitches himself as the party of the bush. But, I don't know that you'd get too far in many country pubs with Bob. Yeah, so maybe it's time for Country Labor to have another go.
Okay, so, Anya.
My question is also sort of to all of you, because you all seem to agree that the biggest sentiment to come out of this election from the voters was dissatisfaction. And so I wanted to ask whether you think that the vote for the Greens this time around was mostly a protest vote, or whether there was going to be, whether it signified sort of a lasting shift to green politics, and more broadly, whether the voting in this election shows anything lasting about the changing voter preferences, whether this is a changing trend or whether it's kind of just a pox on both your houses and people will go back to voting the way they did before once they're more satisfied.
Well, aberration or long-term change? So quick responses from Paul and Peter, perhaps.
I think the interesting thing is that the Greens were the only party in this election on climate change supporting the immediate introduction of a carbon price. So the circumstances were quite unusual in that respect. And a lot of people who were concerned about climate change and saw that neither Gillard nor Abbott were committed to immediate action on a carbon price would have naturally had an incentive to vote Green. Now, this situation will change as we go into the future. And if, in fact, we do have a carbon price legislated by one side of politics or the other, and this becomes the new policy settlement, then the Greens will no longer have such an advantage. So while I recognise the Greens are the big winners and that Green politics is on the rise, both sides, both Liberal and Labor, know ultimately to succeed they have to incorporate green agendas. So I'm not convinced in our system of compulsory voting, where the major parties have to accommodate the requirements of the electorate overall, that we are going to see the Greens making inevitable progress from where they are at the moment.
Do you want to make a quick response?
Yes, sure. The growth of the Greens in this election was essentially a residual of what the major parties failed to do. The best evidence for that is, first, Labor's primary vote collapsed the moment Kevin Rudd decided to walk away from continuing the fight on climate change. The Greens' vote surged, Labor's fell. Then, the moment that Julia Gillard took the Prime Ministership, there was a surge of hope among the progressive vote that she was going to be the new champion of climate change. Labor's primary vote zoomed up again. The Greens' vote fell again. But it was, of course, a case of mistaken identity. And within days, Gillard made clear that she was at least as conservative as Rudd, probably more so, and even more reluctant to act on climate change. Labor's vote fell again, and the Greens' vote zoomed up again. The Greens' strength in this election is essentially a residual of the failure of Labor to pick up this issue. And if the major parties won't, the Greens will prosper, as Paul said. If the major parties do, well, the Greens will be out of a job.
You need to say anything, or you're right? Claire's right. Okay. Robin, down the back. Aren't you behind you? Yeah. We've got to be, brief, okay?
Question to Paul. Given the events, at least up until the time of the election, with Julia Gillard, for instance, saying, I decide, does it worry you that the Australian polity is morphing, as it were, towards what Lord Hailsham once described as elective dictatorship? And if the, where does the role of the Senate, given the populism in the electoral process, the role of traditional role of the Senate as an intellectual house of review come in? If, in fact, one of the aspects which is going to be discussed by the independents is review of parliamentary processes, there would seem to be an intrinsic contradiction between Robert Oakeshott's, I think it was, position to the effect that part of this would be getting along with the Greens in the Senate, and the concept of having a Senate as a house of review. So I guess, okay, how can you strengthen those sorts of processes?
Okay. Paul, an answer that's briefer than the question.
I don't think we're in an elected dictatorship. I think the essential problems for the Rudd government was not overstrong government, but too cautious and weak government. I think that we will see some improvements in governance as a result of the deal with the independents. But remember, the Senate is exercising its authority as a house of review. It knocked out the ETS.
Talking about the Greens and how they hope to act as a review and ameliorate legislation, I think back to Meg Lees and the Democrats ameliorating the GST was the end of the Democrats. It seems almost as if those protest parties have to oppose rather than improve.
So the question is, do protest parties like the Democrats and the Greens have to oppose? What about you, Claire?
Well, I think it's worth remembering that during the campaign, the message that I heard Bob Brown repeating most was, we have a record of fiscal rectitude. You know, we passed the stimulus measures through the Senate, and we negotiated the best deal on that. It's due to the Greens that Australia survived the global financial crisis. And that was a serious point being pushed by Bob Brown. And I think it is possible to see those minor parties as having a job to just wreck. And I think it's possible for people within those parties to see that as their job, and that's going to be the danger with the independents too. I guess it comes down to how responsible they can be. Maybe in the Greens, in the Senate, the Greens are a little bit more used to it. I don't know, but as you say, they don't have much of a template to go on with the Democrats.
There's a question there.
My question is to Paul Kelly. You alluded to the fact that the result of the election is one of the great failures on the part of the Australian Labor Party. Premier Bligh refers to the New South Wales disease and not wanting that to cross the border between New South Wales and Queensland and infect her premiership, I suppose. How much is the New South Wales disease, meaning the role played by people like Senator Mark Arbib and Mr. Bittar, responsible for the result of the election and the poor performance of the Australian Labor Party, given the very apparently good state of our economy?
Is it all Sussex Street's fault, is the question. Yeah.
Well, there's certainly a problem with Sussex Street, but I think the issue is a broader one. The Labor Party's changed. It changed during the Howard period. It's influenced very much by the success of state Labor governments, the model initiated by Bob Carr, followed by Mike Rann, Peter Beattie, Steve Brax. And essentially, this model's been taken to Canberra. This is the Labor Party culture. This is the culture that now exists. Rudd and Gillard were not intellectual children of Hawke and Keating. They were not fashioned by the 1980s. They are the generation beyond that, and they don't have that spirit of reformism pulsating through their political veins. Labor is different, and Labor's been fashioned by these more contemporary situations facing state Labor governments. This is where the focus groups and the polling become critically important. And I think this is one of the big judgments about Rudd's prime ministership. At the end of the day, he wasn't a conviction politician. He wasn't really a reformer. He was fashioned in the mould of the state Labor governments. And that, I think, is the really critical point.
Peter, do you want to make a point on Sussex Street?
Sure.
Harold sells well in Sussex.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's the Chinatown. It's all the Chinese restaurants. On the Democrats, remember, campaigned to keep the bastards honest. Their problem was they just ended up being a bunch of bastards. It was the internal factionalism and fractionalism that destroyed them. But on the Sussex Street problem, I thought that was very funny, Anna Bligh saying that, because, of course, she's the beneficiary of the Sussex Street modus operandi, that is, that you don't care about the purpose of the party or the leader, you change the leader to extend the grip on power. That's why she's there. Is it the problem? You bet it's the problem. Why was Rudd? Why did Rudd eventually decide to take the fatal step of abandoning the fight over the emissions trading scheme? Well, it was the Sussex Streetization of the party, the capture of leadership by the apparatchiks with the polling and the focus groups that finally prevailed, that persuaded the leadership group, the Gang of Four running that government, that it was too hard to fight an election based on electricity prices. That was the essence of that decision. Rudd quailed in the face of the strength of the argument and the so-called research, abandoned the mission, and was punished accordingly. And that was through the near irresistible pressure of the Sussex Streetization, if you like, brought to bear through the apparatchiks. And finally, of course, having succumbed to it a little bit, he ended up succumbing to it totally.
So we go to John O'Neill. And we're getting very close to ending now, I think.
So I was just reflecting in my mind about some of the significant problems of the ALP, that the cabinet seems to be a no ticket, no start. You have to be a trade unionist or one of the three sons of former parliamentarians. Is that a good way to run the country when there's no one with a science degree, there's no one with an engineering background, and there's probably not too many in the cabinet that would know the difference between 100 million and 1,000 million that makes up a billion?
I missed the last part of that.
There's no one in the cabinet who's numerate, I think, is the allegation, I think it's fair to say.
Right.
An allegation, yes.
Well, it's interesting. I mean,
The Labor Party seems to be criticised from both sides. I was moderating yesterday a debate online between Paul Howes and Malcolm Turnbull, who are kind of having a strange, aggressive bromance over Twitter lately. And Malcolm Turnbull's greatest accusation against the union movement was that there was no one who was now a union secretary who had any experience on the shop floor whatsoever. So I think there are certainly plenty of people in the Labor cabinet who've come up through through the unions, and there are plenty of people who've come up sort of in union-associated sectors, like Julia Gillard, for example, who was a lawyer working for the unions. I think Wayne Swan would argue that he's pretty numerous. Whether he knows the difference between millions and trillions and billions, you'd have to ask Barnaby Joyce, I don't know.
John, we'll go up to George Mortimer, but John O'Neill's problem may be solved, because if this Democratic Labor Party man gets up in Victoria, he's from Ballarat and he's a boilermaker. No, he's not. He's a what? He's a blacksmith. And he actually does it. So we can get the small horse in and everything will be fine. So there you are. But
Tony Abbott rejected.
Now, we're going to finish with George Mulderborough. Okay, George.
Does anyone have a
hang
view?
On, just George, just 1 second. Okay, here we go.
Does anyone have a view as to who the leaker was? And to what extent did the leaks shape the second week of the campaign, at least it happened, and to what extent did they shape the rest of the campaign?
Well, this was an election between Laurie Oakes and Peter Hartsch, wasn't it?
Well, before non-answering that question, on the previous question, Kevin Rudd disproved your thesis when he first got the job of Prime Minister because, of course, he had no union affiliation and got it in spite of the trade unions. But his downfall proves your thesis, because the reason that he ended up having no factional backup and support and why his leadership was so fragile was that he didn't have any union affiliations or any of the power blocks that go with that. Yes, there are three people at least who know who the leaker was. I'm one of them, but I'm not going to tell you. The only reason people trust journalists with information on a confidential basis is they know that the confidences will be kept, and that's why there's this tremendous industry around guessing and speculating. I think it's very funny and very entertaining and wildly, wildly misinformed, but I'm afraid I can't do anything to inform it.
Are you going to do an Alan Ramsey? Because he told the story about his famous 1971 leak last year. He kept the secret for 40 years, and then he told us. Now, I'm just going to finish with the final general question. Final general question, very briefly. All three of you have spoken about the possibility of another election. If that occurred in the next 6 months, I mean, what do you think would the scenario be then? So let's start with, go in the reverse order, start with Paul, Claire and Peter. Just what might be looking at by the middle of 2011?
Well, it's very tricky not knowing who's going to be the initial Prime Minister, speculating which side will be in government, which side will be in opposition 6 months out. I do think it's going to be difficult for whoever forms a government. I think this is going to be a tricky exercise. Particularly as time goes on, I can envisage that initially there'll be a tremendous commitment on all sides to make it work, but the strains will come in, the strains will kick in. Just look at the strains we saw in Rudd's first term. I mean, we could never have predicted what happened, that was a strong Prime Minister with a fantastic polling result in the country, with a commanding majority, and look at what happened to him. So I think in that sort of situation it is going to be very, very difficult. I think, as I said, there won't be a crisis, but the risk is that we just have an incremental deterioration in policy outcomes.
I think if we had another election today, Tony Abbott would be elected with a much stronger vote. I think whatever happens in the election, if we have another one, will depend on how much bloodletting the Labor Party engages in publicly now. And in the last 3 days, we've seen a spectacular fight blow up, which has done nothing to address voters' main concern with the Labor Party, which is that they're not fit to govern. It'll depend, really, I guess, what happens. But I think a really important thing to remember is that neither Malcolm Turnbull nor Kevin Rudd would have decided to recontest their electorates if they didn't think that they could be leaders of their parties again. Mm-hmm. I think both of them want that and think that they can get it. So that'll be entertaining.
See
Well, given the wild improbability of everything that's happened so far, given the fact that if a year ago you'd said to people the next Australian election is going to be fought between Julia Gillard and Tony Abbott, given the complete unpredictability of the fact that we've ended up with a complete dead heat, with the independents controlling our national future, with a potential big decision in the hands of the Governor-General, with the Governor-General then having to turn around and say, well, just hang on, I might have been compromised by the fact that my daughter is married to one of the faceless men. Given the fact that we may find ourselves not only with a complete political deadlock between utterly improbable candidates and a constitutional deadlock between a completely ridiculous family soap opera, putting all that together, my money's on the miniature horse.
Well, I'll be very brief. Unfortunately, I couldn't call everyone here tonight. There's a big audience, and I promised to finish by 7. But when the Institute put this together only a couple of weeks ago, we didn't really expect it would be such an entertaining night. So many people would turn up, and but we asked 3 people, and they've performed terrifically. It's been a terrific night. So many thanks to Paul Kelly, Claire Harvey, and Peter Hartcher. I've learned a lot. We've all had a lot of fun. There's been a lot of humour and a lot of very important points. And it'll be up on our podcast tomorrow. But for tonight, just to say thanks to our 3 speakers for a great effort. Well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.